are more important than ever. The group's report focuses on the more than 100 power plants that ring the Great Lakes area, as we hear in this report from WBAI's Jose Santiago.
The report looks at what the Natural Resources Defense Council calls the 25 worst polluters of the Great Lakes, and its release was timed to influence the outcome of what they say are efforts in the U.S. Senate to gut EPA standards to limit toxic airborne emissions from coal-fired power plants. Cindy Copeland, author of the report.
25 of the dirtiest coal-fired power plants in the Great Lakes region are responsible for half the region's mercury pollution. The states of Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Indiana, where there are no state-level mercury controls, are home to the region's worst mercury polluters. Those three states are followed in order by Michigan, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and New York. The Great Lakes region's five worst coal-fired power plants for mercury pollution are Shawville in Clearfield County, Pennsylvania, Monroe in Monroe County, Michigan, Homer City in Indiana County, Pennsylvania, Cardinal in Jefferson County, Ohio, and Sherburn County in Sherburn County, Minnesota. Here's an interesting point. A dozen power plants in Ohio and Indiana, owned in whole or part by American Electric Power, accounted for 19% of all mercury emitted in 2010 from the 144 coal-fired power plants in the Great Lakes region.
In releasing the report, the NRDC cited long-established evidence showing that mercury emitted by coal-fired plants is especially toxic to pregnant women and their fetuses. Dr. Peter Orris of the University of Illinois Hospital and Health Science System says mercury manifests itself in the Great Lakes as methyl mercury, which he says works its way up the food chain to contaminate fish, at the same time that physicians are telling women they should eat more fish while pregnant.
The difficulty primarily needs to be targeted on pregnant women and women that will be getting pregnant in the next year, because it is this methyl mercury that is eaten out of the fish that has a negative impact on the neurologic development of the child, because it is almost impossible for women to identify which fish have more mercury than others. And this is particularly a problem because fish as a whole are very good, as they say, brain food, and brain food for the developing infant as well. So you really want to urge women in this situation that they ought to be eating fish. They need to be eating fish low in mercury. That urging in the physician's office is almost impossible to carry out, which is why we need to move on the public health point of view to primary prevention and reducing the amount of mercury in the overall environment.
But gutting the EPA's ability to reduce mercury in the overall environment, says the Natural Resources Defense Council, is not the way to go. Thomas Smarr is an attorney with the Chicago office of the NRDC.
EPA's authority to adopt these critical safeguards goes back to 1990, when the first President Bush signed amendments to the Clean Air Act that were passed by overwhelming bipartisan majorities in Congress and directed EPA to set standards on major sources such as power plants. But now, 22 years later, Congress is seeking to roll back these and other basic provisions of the Clean Air and Clean Water Act that have protected our health and environment for decades. Next week, we expect there will be a vote in the U.S. Senate on a resolution that would void EPA's mercury and air toxic standards and permanently block EPA from reissuing similar safeguards. At stake in this vote are the thousands of lives that would be saved every year by the EPA standards and the hundreds of thousands of avoided respiratory illnesses and lost workdays. Many power companies support EPA standards, along with doctors, nurses, scientists, and public health professionals. We have all known for years that these standards were imminent, and many companies have already invested millions to reduce their mercury and toxic air emissions. Other industries have worked hard to clean up their own pollution. And rolling back EPA's power plant standards now would unfairly penalize those companies that have invested money to modernize their plants, while granting amnesty to the laggards that have disregarded the law and kept polluting and harming our children's health.
The Senate is expected to take up the issue next week. For WBAI News, I'm Jose Santiago.
And that's some of the news for Wednesday, June 6th, 2012. The news was produced in New York with Jose Santiago and Linda Perry. I'm Andrea Sears in New York for the WBAI, listener-supported news.
And this is WBAI in New York, listener-supported freeform radio broadcasting at 99.5 megahertz FM and streaming at WBAI.org. Greetings. My name is Robert Knight, and the upcoming program is Earthwatch, in which, following a monumental astronomical week of a lunar eclipse and a Venus solar transit, we find ourselves confounded by sudden change and feelings of love. In that regard, our program tonight is dedicated to the lives and memory of two great creators, Ray Bradbury and Steve Ben Israel. Stay tuned, more to come. This is Earthwatch.
I suppose you wonder why I've called you all here. I want to identify myself.
Yeah, well, okay, here we go. This is WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 megahertz FM. And this is indeed Earthwatch, and we'll be back right after this.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. The beating sound of the hammer for justice that pounds. When will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? He looks upon us with a frown to know that millions of babies still starve. Millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. Someone still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent one still die. When will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? We've been missing. the man in the moon must have found. 'Cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. As long as there's life, there's still a day. As long as there's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
And as long as there's daylight, we have a life. This is Earthwatch on WBAI Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 megahertz and streaming at WBAI.org. My name is Robert Knight. I'm your astrogator. And tonight we travel some sad distances because of the loss of two people of great brilliance and souls bound to the concept of freedom, if that is not a contradiction in terms. Over the past 48 hours, we've lost two brilliant people. One of them, the New York and national legend, Steve Ben Israel, who passed about 36 to 48 hours ago of a long illness. Here in New York City, the place that he loved, he was a longtime friend of ourselves, this show, this station, and this network called Pacifica, and living genius. Also, a masseur of our imagination, in the person of Ray Bradbury, the great writer of speculative fiction, as Jim Freund would describe it. And I urge you to stay tuned throughout the entire evening, from Earthwatch to Hour of the Wolf to Lister. This is going to be a mission-fulfilling night for WBAI. And Jim does a program on science fiction, fantasy, and speculative fiction, and I knew well before I arrived at the studios tonight that Jim might probably have something to say about the great Ray Bradbury, who died yesterday in Los Angeles at the age of 91 after what is being described as a lengthy illness. Life itself could be described as that. He is the author of a great many books that are called science fiction, or speculative fiction, if you will. And among them are The Illustrated Man and The Martian Chronicles, and very dear to my heart, Fahrenheit 451, a book that began under the title of The Fireman, and became emblematic of the concept of freedom, and could be identified by its tagline or epigram. A repressive state, to paraphrase, need not really burn books, but only convince people not to read. You know, I was on a desert island once, and I had the greatest library in the world, like that guy on the old Twilight Zone show, you know, in the library after the nuclear war. And I had every book on my little Kindle, my electronic book called the Kindle. But I committed suicide because my batteries ran out. Bradbury was long a proponent of reading and writing every day. And he wrote the book Fahrenheit 451 based on the idea that the average burning temperature of paper is approximately 451 degrees Fahrenheit. And you could do no better than consider his admonition that we increase our wisdom through the random access nature of a book and the non-industrial dependence of these electronic books. So we begin our memorial edition tonight of Earthwatch with this salute to Ray Bradbury that comes to us courtesy of an institution you have funded, a public institution just like Pacifica, the National Endowment for the Arts, where director Lawrence Bridges produced this brief conversation with Ray Bradbury. This is Earthwatch.
I suppose you wonder why I've called you all here. I want to identify myself. I'm Ray Bradbury. But you're very curious, aren't you, to find out how I fell in love with books. I learned to read when I was 3 years old. I loved comic strips. I loved the cartoons on Sunday. And I got a book of fairy tales when I was 5 years old. And I fell in love with reading. And when I was six, I saw a film on dinosaurs. And dinosaurs filled my life. A thing that begins when you're 3 and 6 and 10 and 12 wind up in your fictions when you're in your 30s. The things that you do should be things that you love. And things that you love should be things that you do. I was 7 years old when I went to the library for the first time. And I was hoping to find books about The Land of Oz by L. Frank Baum and Tarzan by Edgar Rice Burroughs. That was a great adventure. And I'd open the door of the library and I'd look in and all those people were waiting for me in there. You see, libraries is people. People are waiting in there. Thousands of people who wrote the books. My greatest influences are John Steinbeck. I read The Grapes of Wrath when I was 19 years old. So you find the author who can lead you through the dark. And Shakespeare started me there. And Hamlet started me there. And Richard III. And Emily Dickinson led the way for me. And Edgar Allan Poe said, "This way, here's the light." That's what a library is. So you go into the library and discover yourself. Long at night when I was 12 years old, and I looked at the planet Mars, and I said, "Take me home." And the planet Mars took me home. I never came back. So I've written every day in the last 75 years. I've never stopped writing. We should learn from history about the destruction of books. When I was 15 years old, Hitler burned books in the streets of Berlin. So I learned then how dangerous it all was, because if you didn't have books and the ability to read, you couldn't be part of any civilization. You couldn't be part of a democracy. If you know how to read, you have a complete education about life. Then you know how to vote within a democracy. But if you don't know how to read, you don't know how to decide. That's the great thing about our country, is we are a democracy of readers, and we should keep it that way. I published the first version of Fahrenheit in February 1951. When I moved into L.A. with my family, I had two daughters. I needed an office because my daughters were very loud and wonderful and lovely. But I had no money for an office. I was wandering around up at UCLA, and I heard typing in a room down in the basement. And I went down to the basement, and I found a room with had 12 typewriters in it. I could rent a typewriter for 10 cents a half hour. So I said, "My God, this is my office. Doesn't matter. I was surrounded by students." I got a bag of dimes. I moved into the typing room in the basement of the library. And I spent $9 and $9.80. And I wrote Fahrenheit 451. So you see, what a place for Fahrenheit 451 to be written. In a library of all places where it wasn't being burned. So I made a contract with Ballantyne. And I went to the library again, where with the typing in the typing room, and I added 25,000 words. How did I do that? I got the characters to come to me. Montag came and said, "Do you know who I am completely?" I said, "No." I said, "Tell me." And the fire chief came to me, and he told me about his prior life. I said to the fire chief, "Why did you burn books?" And he told me. And Clarice McClellan came, who was a 16-year-old girl who was in love with books and libraries and life. Clarice is me. Clarice McClellan is Ray Bradbury, the young boy who fell in love with life. And Clarice is the essence of life and the essence of love. You see, all my characters write the book. I don't write the book. All these characters come to me and say, "Listen to me." And then I listen to them and I put it down and the book gets written. That's how I write, you see. All these lovers surround me and they love life and they tell me about it. At the center of my books is the gift of life. The reason why my books are popular because they know I'm a lover. When people touch my books, they are alive. So that's the gift I give to them, and I want them to carry them back and forth to the library. Books are smart and brilliant and wise. Love what you do and do what you love. Don't listen to anyone else who tells you not to do it. You do what you want, what you love. But imagination should be the center of your life. Fantasy at the center of your life. I'm going to have a t-shirt made. It says, "Stand at the top of the cliff and jump off and build your wings on the way down." We are all the sons and the daughters of time. So I thank the universe for making life on Earth and allowing me to come alive here.
Fahrenheit 451, Utopia, for the Freedom of Thought novel by the late Ray Bradbury. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight in New York. You tuned to WBAI, or perhaps streaming at WBAI.org. And we now move to a death even closer to home about a day and a half ago. One of the great friends of Earthwatch and WBAI and Pacifica, an indefatigable creator by the name of Stephen Ben Israel. He lived as an actor, a poet, a composer, a comedian, a hip-hop rapper, a philosopher and performance artist, Steve Ben Israel. He succumbed to a long illness with the industrial disease of cancer at his home here in New York City. And he is a veteran of the Living Theater from the Lower East Side, something that even before Strasberg was defining the craft of acting. And another alumnus of that great institution is our own broadcast colleague, Bob Fass, who's on this time Thursday evenings at midnight. And Steve and Bob were great friends for many years and shared many experiences. So I commend your attention to Radio Unnameable with Bob Fass 24 hours from now. Steve lived as a family man, a beatnik, a hippie, a yippie, a performer. He composed a set piece called Nonviolent Executions that traveled all across the country. And his insight and wit was a very important part of the attitudes, concepts, and contrary ideas that we call freedom today, that historians might call anarchism, that anybody alive would call just great fun. Fun with a side of wit. Steve was very much concerned with freedom, social and ethnic justice, and international understanding, and nowhere might that be more evident than in a recent work of his on the occasion of the decennial 10th anniversary of the events of 11 September 2001, in which the clarity of his memory and depiction brought me once again to the edge of tears.
This poem is called, Do You Remember? I Remember. Do you remember that morning when the planes crashed into the World Trade Center and turned us all into dust? Do you remember the Xerox copies of the photos of the lost and cell phone numbers written in magic markers that were plastered all over the walls of the city with their deadly cry of hope? Do you remember the beautiful poetry that turned up a few days later alongside the photos of the lost? I remember standing on Canal Street that morning, watching the towers coming down, the crowd around me breaking into tears while others too shocked in disbelief. I remember a black man who got out alive and covered from head to toe in white dust asked me if I could get him a beer. I remember going to a hardware store to buy myself a mask, but they were sold out, so I bought an American flag handkerchief on the corner and wrapped it around my face like the Long Ranger. People walking by said, excuse me, may I take your picture? Do you remember the wilted flowers stuck on all the chain-link fences around the city? Do you remember nobody blew their horn for 3 months in New York City? Do you remember the anthrax scare? I remember calling the great Arnie Sacca and a big fan of WBAI, and said, Arnie, he said, who's this? I said, Steve. He said, Steve. I said, Arnie. And at the same time, we said the Reichstag fire. Do you remember freedom fries? Do you remember the cops from Atlanta and Miami parked in the village and everyone starting conversations and thanking them for coming up to help with shock talk? Do you remember the attackers were from Saudi Arabia and met in Afghanistan and then the USA destroyed the country? Do you remember all the flags and flag buttons on the jackets to show you were truly American, and folks wearing baseball hats that said NYPD, FDNY, and USA? I remember all that Uncle Sam's old glory. Do you remember the checkpoints on Canal Street and Houston Street and 14th Street and 23rd Street and so on? I had to show my ID 3 times when walking home. Do you remember the Middle Eastern profiling and the Indian man in Staten Island who was killed wearing a turban for revenge as the heat was taken off black people for a minute? Do you remember the cries for revenge and the bodies keep piling up and it's still not enough? I remember our son Baba stranded in Staten Island calling me from a phone booth telling me about all the papers that blew in from Manhattan. Do you remember Orange Alert and what's in your bag? Do you remember Union Square and all the great vibes and music and the 3 black boys singing Beatle tunes and their father was on washtub bass drowning out the politicos chanting their chickens have come home to roost? I remember one of my neighbors was part of the cleanup crew and gave me a burnt quarter. Do you remember walking by the firehouses with the mountains of flowers all around and going over to firefighters and shaking their hands and trying to find the right words? I remember going to Ladder Company 39 because my friend Keith Glasso had worked there, and I gave out copies of my Warm It Up poem. They made me coffee, the firefighters did, and we talked what a beautiful man Keith was. I met his parents a week later. There were tears underneath my shades, and they were so stoic. I remember my great friend Tony Fish Nunziata rang my bell, and I couldn't recognize his voice, but I buzzed him in anyhow, and he walking up the stairs wearing a fireman's suit and his face full of gray dust. I said, can I help you? He said, it's me, Tony. I said, what are you doing in that outfit? He said, I've been putting out fires down at Ground Zero as a volunteer. He started to wash up. I could see his face now. He said, as soon as he heard about the first plane crashing into the tower, I ran over to our local firehouse and told them I'm a Vietnam veteran, a former lifeguard, and that I'm in pretty good shape. And they said, suit this guy up. I held those heavy giant fire hoses for nearly 4 hours. Tony Fish Nunziata died last year. And if I wonder if he got that lymphoma at Ground Zero, or maybe he got it in Vietnam. I miss him so. I remember coming out of the Spring Street subway, and there were 6 soldiers with AK-47s and machine guns. I said, how you guys doing, and where are you from? I told the guy from Boston that one day the Red Sox would win the World Series. Do you remember the great fear that came upon us from the terrorists and from the White House that tried to stop all our visions of a better world and the paranoia that still hangs over us? Do you remember there was a big difference talking to folks before and after we invaded those countries? I remember I had to gather all my love and keep it working for me, and it's still so hard. Do you remember, and you wondered if it would ever get any better than this, and you still do? I remember changing my answering machine message to, hi, you've reached Steve, Pamela, and Baba, we're out making the world a better place to live in. At the beep, leave a message.
The late Steve Ben Israel. On the occasion of the 10th anniversary of the events of 11 September 2001. This is Earthwatch. My name is Robert Knight, and we're mourning the loss of a friend tonight. Steve and I communicated with many emails and personal encounters, including each of his latest breathless works, and one of them seems appropriate at this moment, called The Best of Nothing, which reads as follows. I have been speaking for years to immigrants, asking them why they came to America. They say there was nothing for them back home. I said, welcome to America, the best of nothing. Steve was a longtime proponent of peace and one of the best examples thereof might well be during the dark days of the first invasion of Iraq in 1993 at a peace rally event at the Village Gate in Lower Manhattan. Steve put forward this brilliant performance.
Next guest is, for decades, has been performing in street theater and innovative theater all over the world. He's been spreading anarchy all over the world, and that's not a put-down. Steve Ben Israel is that guest. He's performed his first benefit here at the Village Gate in 1961 for the General Strike for Peace, produced by the Living Theater. He worked with the Living Theater for many years, and he continues to hold seances to try to contact the living. Steve Ben Israel.
Thank you, thank you. That's my Christian name. I live a few blocks away over here in Soho, where you can buy a painting of a regular pizza for $12,000. But a painting of a Sicilian will cost you $18,500. There's been a lot of changes in America since the coming of the Reagan-Bush era. I was walking down 15th Street and West Street one night, and there used to be the old Federal House of Detention. And I've been there a couple of times over the years, nothing serious, a little civil disobedience, in and out. And I was walking by there one night, and now it's a condominium. And I can't get in there now. The Reagan-Bush era got in at that particular time, and the first thing about the era began when Reagan said, I'm not quite sure about evolution. All the facts aren't in yet. I think that was a clue for what was to come. And when he said that, I went, what? And you know, I was rethinking that also myself at that particular time because of that line. Because when America started, we had Thomas Paine, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and then we got Reagan, Bush, Weinberger, Schultz, Mies, Elliot Abrams, Alphonse D'Amato. So maybe Darwin was wrong. So I've been rethinking that myself. Reagan had some great hits like Come Back to Grenada, the Cubans are gone, Canciano Airport, Ronald Reagan. The other side was, AWAC! You want an AWAC? How about a stealth missile? How about a B-1 bomber? How about some nerve gas? How about a limited nuclear war? A window of invulnerability? Star Wars? The Peacekeeper? Sounded like some high-budget horror movie to me.
Halloween, Friday the 13th, Mother's Day, Motel Hell, Dress to Kill, Maniac, Theta Black, The Shining, The Howling, The Changeling. Don't answer the phone. He knows you're alone. When a stranger calls, Scanners, Blood Beach, Dawn of the Dead, Deadly Blessing, Sleepaway Camp. And the terror continues with budget cuts.
Budget cuts. You won't even be able to afford to go see it.
Don't open up your refrigerator. There's nothing there.
Budget cuts, closing down a theater near you.
You know, the horror movies of the 1980s are very different than the movies of the 1930s. The horror movies of the 1930s were always very supernatural. It would start out with the Swan-like ballet.
Dracula,
Frankenstein. The Wolfman. Hello, Marianne. I don't think I can make our date tonight. No. I'm feeling kind of strange. I have a headache. No. I'll be fine. No. I'll make myself some tea, and I'll call you in the morning. Bye-bye.
The Mummy. Princess Hananka. And,
The horror movies of the 1980s are very different. The horror movies of the 1980s, it's the guy next door. He had a funny childhood. He saw all those movies. And they're all about slashing up women, you know.
And as you may have heard, the man-woman thing is complicated enough.
With the Supreme Court. And Reagan passed this baton, I think it was called the Iran contraception. To Bush. Quail. The mind is a terrible thing. I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. The bush quail atmosphere, okay? During that period, the early period of the bush quail atmosphere, I was seriously thinking about giving up English. I found out that when I spoke English, I had to translate into English and garnished. I would speak English and people would go, what? And then I would translate into English and they would go, huh? I said, oh, this man. Giving up, I'm like, oh, language man, you know, I'm giving up, oh, in English, German, Italian, French, Arabic, Yiddish, I'm giving up, I'm like, oh, and I'm good at this. I'm good at words. For example, abolish capital punishment. The people have always been punished by capital. Okay, I'm good with this. Another one. I've been thinking of selling out, man, but the line is too long. So I'm good with words, man, but I'm giving up. I'm going into pure sound, man. Well, maybe I'll hold on to a couple of words like help and hey kid, look out for that car. But I decided to go into pure sound. Ooh, gee, oh, ah. Ah. Hey, that sounds good. I like that. So there I am. Ooh. I want to wrap my smoking joint. I want to see the human face. The human face. Talk to the human face. The maximum experience. I want to talk. But all of a sudden, comes the Berlin Wall. Changes are happening in Eastern Europe and Russia. And I say, beautiful. Because now, when I talk to Americans about change, they're no longer going to think I was talking about shit. So I sang that part of the world, a good luck song. Lithuania, Albania, Romania, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Poland, Eastern Germany, and Hungary, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, and Moldavia, Estonia, Turkmenia, Macedonia, and Latvia, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Georgia, Russia, and the Ukraine. Good luck. Cold War was over. The Cold War was over. I said, you know, man, everybody was saying, you know, man, all that stuff and energy that went for destruction is not going to be used for human services, man. I'm sorry. Huh? What? I'm sorry. And all of a sudden, I begin to get sand in my eyes. It became very slippery under my foot. And I could hear my mother's voice from the grave going, oil. It was the first war in history that you knew when the opening night was. January 15th. And one day, it started! Bush was crazy, but who's sane? And we all watched that death. On CNN, the military home shopping channel.
Well, Daisy, what do we have in this opening segment?
Well, Colonel, we have some small arms fire, and we have some M1 MA tanks, and they are simply gorgeous. Switch to every dictator, Shah, Emir, Premier, President, Prime Minister, Chief King around the globe with a satellite dish watching CNN going,
Federico, bring the legal size paper and pencil. Come quick. Look. Whoa.
Yes, I'll take some we'll take some small arms fires, and I will take 10 of those M1 MA tanks. Simply gorgeous is good? Okay. No, I don't want Scuds. I want Patriots. patriots. So I went to that Victory for the Gulf march downtown with 2 million New Yorkers. Victory for the Gulf. 2 million people with the American flag, women jumping out of the crowd past the cops, going over to Marines, kissing them on the cheek like VE Day. I walked over to this cop and I said, "Hey, Sarge, how can a guy be lonely in a city of 8 million? I made my way up Church Street uptown. They're really doing it to me, man. Yugoslavia, Somalia, Middle East, Los Angeles. Man, you know, I'm seriously thinking about giving up English again. What a drag. Dun 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 dun. Hey, I'm a bullfighter. I fight the bull. Actually, I fight to keep the bull alive. Actually, I fight to keep all living creatures alive. Actually, I fight to keep the roar and the passion of the crowd for blood, but not for blood. But not for blood. You know why? You know what time it is? Gee, it's past World War II. Hi. Hello. Ding, 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 ding. Ding. It's not the blacks. It's not the Jews. It's not the Puerto Ricans. It's not the Haitians. It's not the Asians. Hello, are you there? Bing, 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 bing. Wait, 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 wait. There you are. Okay? It's not the blacks. It's not the Jews. It's not the Puerto Ricans, the Haitians, the Asians. It's not the South Africans. It's not the Germans. It's not the Japanese. It's not the Kikuyus. It's not the Danes. It's not the Zulus. It's not the Dutch. It's not the Libyans. It's not the Iraqis. It's me. It's my fault the world is fucked up. I'm sorry. I'll get better. The world will get better. You'll get better. Good night, Dizzy Gillespie. We love you.
The brilliance of the late Steve Ben Israel. This is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York, streaming at WBAI.org. My name is Robert Knight, and we have more. And we have a narrow window if there are some of you who might have known and or loved Steve Ben Israel for your phone calls at area code 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. And here's another little poem he sent me not so long ago called Camping. There was someone who used to put crusts of bread under the pillows of people in Auschwitz. No one knew who it was, because if they knew, So would the Nazis. Now, you can put bread on top of the pillows or anywhere else. And it's okay if everybody knows. Steve Ben Israel. 212-209-2900. Got a number of calls off the air. And there's still more to come, including our encounter with Steve on the occasion of the death of Thule Kupferberg, another bright star in the constellation of American culture. And we are today, one might say, mourning. But that is what follows a dark day, isn't it? We are celebrating the lives of Steve Ben Israel and Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451. 212-209-2900, if you are so inclined. And this is Earthwatch, and you are on the air. Hello? Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, Robert, you broke my heart today when you told me about Steve, but you also healed it. He was so funny and so lovable. And believe me, the other fellow, Thule, oh, everything about Thule, he was like, if they think all those great writers, like whoever the Jewish writers are, there's no question that Thule was everything. He could draw, he could make you laugh, he could sing, he could make jokes. He was every man. He was like, I guess, Chaucer to me, a modern version. I'm
very
really
good, very good anything. Reference. I appreciate that. That's
to
very
me,
good.
To me, like Chaucer. And Bradbury, you also told us about him? Oh, Robert, this is, remember I told you I didn't like you anymore? Well, this is the old Robert.
Hey.
Your heart is as big as theirs, and especially the last segment that you just did. It was
so tell
like
me.
Thule.
So tell me, how you hate me now?
Oh, no, how could I hate you? Are you nuts? I'll let
well,
other
yes.
people talk. You tell us about his when the day is and all that, okay?
Yes. It is too soon for me to have gotten reliable details.
Well,
but
look how soon.
But tune into Bob Fast tomorrow night at about this time.
I always do anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I love the station. But when you were away, it was a nightmare. That's all I can tell you. It was a hell of a gap.
Well, I prefer to think that during that time it was nightless.
It was. Absolutely, and not only that, that night show, we needed that segment. That was making me mad when we didn't have it. Now we have History Channel, but before we had you on the radio.
Yeah, well, right? we're living history right now.
Yeah, we really are, and thank you for being so on target and playing Steve like that. Oh
man.
You broke my heart and you filled it. That lady laughing in the audience, I love what he said about his mother in the
yes.
grave.
Oh, when she said, oil. Oil.
My mother. She didn't say those words, but yeah. I'm sure my mother. Yeah,
there's an old joke, and you might even recognize it. The punchline is this. I'm not going to tell the joke, but it ends up with the words, oi, how I was suffering.
Well, if I could do my mother's broken English, people were always howling at her broken English. But you know what she told me that was bad, or sort of like a Jewish mother? She said, wait till you have a son. Not a son. Wait till you're a mother. You're going to get what she gave me. Doesn't that sound like a Jewish mother?
It sounds like
get it.
It sounds like every mother.
No, like every mother I meant. When I say Jewish mother, it's what he just said before.
Yeah.
It wasn't so-and-so-and-so. It was me.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for calling.
Yes.
I've got more for you, and if you love Thule, you're going to love what's about to happen here.
Oh, I love Thule so much.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
thank you.
You know, as a matter of fact, let us now proceed. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight. You're tuned to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org or stream.wbai.org on the internet. And during the time of my one of my many returns from exile to WBAI, In July 2010, I had a very meaningful conversation with Steve. And it was about the death at that time of Thule Kupferberg, of the Fugs. And what really comes back to me hearing this again now? Earlier today on 5 O'Clock Shadow, we did an abbreviated version that was not full acoustic fidelity. This is the original stereo version. And I was so inspired by Steve's words and insights that I did a production of this. And we're going to hear this now about Steve celebrating the life of Thule Kupferberg. But here is the secret conceit. Every ounce of praise that the beautiful and generous soul of Steve Ben Israel gave to Thule Kupferberg, the same accolades could be afforded to our dear departed friend, Steve Ben Israel.
This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight. You're listening to WBAI in New York. And I'm speaking with Steve Ben Israel, great performer who, like myself and the rest of us, are mourning the loss of yet another great performer in the person of Thule Kupferberg of the Fugs. Welcome to the show, Steve, once again.
Oh, you're great to be here.
How are you addressing the loss of Thule Kupferberg?
Well, you know, I was up in the hospital a couple of days ago, and he had all these tubes in him, and he was laying there, you know, and I've been at hospital beds too many times over the last many years, and I've seen beautiful cats going out. And, of course, we were always hoping that he'd come back, like the end of one of those great science fiction radio shows when I was a kid, but he didn't. So, you know, it's strange about when a guy lives to be 86, you know, you don't mourn him the same way as somebody who went out at 30, you know. So, of course, you pay homage to that whole life that he had and all the love that he gave out and how loved he was by almost everybody. Thule was like, he made you feel like he was your best friend. So you walk around with another great best friend, and you know, he only lived two blocks away from me, and I remember 31 years ago we took our 5-year-old kids together, his and mine, and we enrolled them in kindergarten. We were a couple of weird looking freaks in this amongst the parents that were showing up depositing their children. And and, you know, when we performed many times together at Coca Crystal's New York cable show, and I, you know, sat down with many times with him over the years, and on this bench on Prince Street, and we talked about all the great anarchist stuff. He asked me 2 years ago, what's the origin of that song, Nobody for President, that Wavy used to sing and guys from the Fireside Theater used to sing? But I told him it was originated by Mel Most from the IWW in 1972. So, and I remember he did it on his TV show when he gave Mel Most the...
Steve Ben Israel recently found this, and we now both believe this, the first use of the immortal phrase, nobody for president. And we're going to sing it. I'm going to sing it. Nobody for president. We don't need a king. All his powers should be ours. Let the people do their thing. And this was sung by Mel Most, an IWW Wobbly member, in 1972. I've brought it down to date, as we say, and I'm going to do the next two new verses. When will that happen? Heaven only knows. Liars fool us. Idiots rule us. And sweet time is on the wing. Bum, bum, bum. Down, you old Democans. Out, rude Republicrats. Rise, miraculous creed. Revelation. Revolution, cast your peaceful, loving seeds.
It's eerie, the parallel of thoughts, the wake of the life of Thule Kupferberg, whether it's the thugs or his poetry or the television program and so many other things. For those who don't even know that they know of some of the consequences of his work, the thugs, and the whole ambiance that you all come out of, take a moment to tell people about who Thule was creatively.
Well, he was a wonderful poet and a wonderful humorist, and he wrote these parasongs. And parasongs were songs that he used traditional melodies and wrote new words. For example, backwoods Jew with soldiers
strolling back from war, hug your Gentile brothers as you've done before. Presidents and premiers perish, empires rise and fall, but hearts of old compassion still might save us all. Yeshu and Kohelet blend wisdom and fresh love. Kiss the hand that helps you, blue sky still above. Backward Jewish soldiers watching from all wars, embrace your Gentile sisters as you've done before. Kings and presidents perish, all empires fade and fall, but hearts of sweet compassion still may save us all. Yeshu and Kohelet blend wisdom and fresh love. Kiss the hand that helps you, blue sky still above. Backward Jewish soldiers strolling back from war, hug your Gentile brothers as you've done before. Presidents and premiers perish, empires rise and fall, but hearts of old compassion still might save us all. Yeshu and Kohelet blend wisdom and fresh love. Kiss the hand that helps you, blue sky still above. Backward Jewish soldiers marching from all wars, embrace your Gentile sisters as you've done before. Kings and presidents perish, all empires fade and fall, but hearts of sweet compassion still may save us all. Kings and presidents perish, all empires fade and fall, but hearts of sweet compassion still may save us all.
Right? And he took a lot of great old tunes that we knew and redid them, and they were always well written and funny. And, you know, he was a tremendous artist going way back, you know, before it really happened, publishing books and reading poetry way back there in the early mid-50s. And besides, he was a great anarchist, pacifist, socialist, which I am also. And so we always greet and talked about the history of that, you know, all the great anarchists over the last 300-400 years that made major contributions. We're always discussing them. But, you know, he was such a beautiful man. You know, that's the greatness of his poetry and his artistry, of who he was and how he came across with people.
You know, he used contradiction so well and yet hilariously, but always with a serious humanistic heart. And, for example, well, a lot of people might know of Thule and the Fogs from the recent Coen Brothers movie, Burn After Reading, the one that starred George Clooney, which ended with his performance, his vocals on the song CIA Man.
Who can kill a general in his bed? Overthrow dictators if they're red. Oh, CIA man. CIA man. Who can buy a government so cheap? Change a cabinet without a squeak. CIA man. CIA man. Who can train gorillas by the dozens? Send them out to kill their untrained cousins. Okay, man. CIA man. Who can get a budget that's so great? Who will be the 51st state? Who has got the secret of service? The one that makes the other service nervous. It's okay, man. CIA man. Who can take the sugar from its sack? Pour in LSD and put it back. CIA man. CIA man. Who can mind the Habas, Nicaragua? Out hit all the hitmen of Chicago. CIA man. CIA man. Who can be so overtly covert? Sometimes even covertly overt. CIA man. CIA man. Who's the agency well known to God? The one that cut the staff and cut the rod. CIA man. CIA man.
There's also, by this contradiction I'm referring to, the song, like, say, Kill for Peace.
Right, right. I guess they couldn't use that one in the regular movie world, you know, but you know, it was such a statement that kill for peace, which is what America was doing during the Vietnam War, and that's why a song came out that kill for peace, which threw everybody, but they soon realized that's what we're doing, we're killing for peace.
Kill for peace. Kill. got to play second fiddle. Kill, kill, kill for peace. Kill, kill, kill for peace. If you let them live, they may subvert the Prussians. If you let them live, they might love the Russians. Kill, kill, kill. Kill them, strafe them good creeps. The only gook an American can trust is a gook that's got his yellow head rust. Kill, kill, kill for peace. Kill, kill, kill for peace. Kill, kill, it'll feel so good, like my captain said it should. Kill, kill, kill for peace. Kill, kill, kill for peace. Kill, it will give you the mental ease. Kill, it will give you a big release. Kill, kill, kill for peace. Kill, kill, kill for peace. Kill, kill, kill for peace.
And that was the greatness of that moment he picked up in history, like I said, during the Vietnam War. And the wars just go on and on and on, and that song is more relevant than ever.
Well, you know, we're living for Thule also, and I trust that, you know, and will convey to the family the love and regard of this audience, this station, this constituency and community.
Yeah.
And I'm... wondering, how are the other group members feeling, you know, today?
I spoke to his wife today, and I spoke to his best friend, Thelma, yesterday. I haven't spoken to Ed or Stephen Taylor or Kobe. Have not been in touch with them lately. But, you know, I guess they'll say it all Saturday at noon at the St. Mark's in the Bowery Church when there's this funeral for Thule, which is going to have so much love in this room. I mean, it's going to be shocking how much love is going to be in this room for Thule. And anybody out there, you know, who needs a little extra love, who's not sure they're getting enough, you show up to this funeral for Thule Kupferberg, and you're going to be blown away with this, the love that's going to be in this room. I just can't wait.
Well, that's going to be a great event, and the territory has already been scouted by our friend and also recordist of the Fogs and of Thule, the late David Nolan. And
yeah.
I swear to God, I got to stop going to church so much.
Yeah, well, you know, it's I always love when Jewish guys, you know, have a funeral in a church. And I remember, like, when my son was married in that church. Baruch Israel, our son's name, was married in that church, and he had a Jewish friend of mine, Judge, marry him. So that's a great church to, like, be in for good days or sad days. It's always a great place to be, and one of the legendary buildings of New York City.
Steve, what are you up to? I know you recently did the nonviolent executions. Are you working
around town? I do that from time to time. I just did a wonderful poetry reading at the Vision Festival. And I perform a lot on hip-hop night, one of the hip-hop nights at the New Eureka Poets Cafe for 15 years. And it's a great experience for me because it's a young hip-hop crowd, and they go crazy for me because, yo, what's up? I'm real and representing, and they respond to me like that. So that's these events that I do twice a month. Always look forward to, you know, like intergenerational stuff. And since our son has been on the hip-hop scene for the last 20 years, he got me to be part of it, and it's a great part of my life to be, you know, me as a guy who's been performing theater for 50 years, also performing on the hip-hop scene. That's the big buzz in my life right now.
That's Steve Ben Israel, and I'm Robert Knight, and you're listening to Earthwatch on WBAI in New York. And Steve, you have the last word, a thought for Thule.
The thought for Thule always is a toast to the future. May it come back.
Steve Ben Israel, thank you so much. I'll be seeing you at the memorial.
Have a great one. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight. You're tuned to WBAI in New York.
This is a song from our first album that's truly, 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 truly applicable to 1984. We've changed the lyrics, or the master, the Noel Coward of the 80s, Julie Kupferberg, has adapted it for the times. But you can sing along with the first verse. They're the same. We want to hear you sing with us.
Monday, nothing. Tuesday, nothing. Wednesday and Thursday, nothing. Friday for a change, a little more, nothing. Saturday, once more, nothing. Roosevelt, fake, nothing. Truman, bloody, nothing. Eisenhower, dopey, nothing. Johnson, Nixon, humongous pricks, and Reagan, atomic death, nothing. And Karl Marx, nothing. Trotsky, nothing. Bakunin and Kropotkin, nothing. John Stuart Mill, nil, nil. Stalin, less than nothing. Idiotics, nothing. Semiotics, nothing. Wittgenstein and Russell, nothing. John Paul Sartre, dead old fodder. Is Heisenberg or is he not? Nothing. Jesus Christ, nothing. Bar Kokhba, nothing. Muhammad and Krishna, nothing. Buddha, nada. Quaalude, nada. Even John Lennon now is nothing. The bottom line is nothing. MTV is nothing. Hollywood and PBS, nothing. The giants of literature, giants of nothing. Littering and spittering, nothing. And marriage is nothing. Ain't divorce something? Well, having kids is nothing. They all grow up and leave you anyway. Lost sons and daughters of nothing. Nothing, 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 nothing.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May. It wasn't so easy getting these shows together. So we thought we'd recreate a Fugs rehearsal, preparing the various songs for this concert. Wake up, Kramer. Let's go. All right, let's do that up-tempo tune we were working on.
Okay, Ed.
One, two, three, four.
I fucked a chicken in the 60s, but now I'm the dean of the medical school. The medical school. The medical school.
No, God. Oh, hey. Let's do that up-tempo tune that we were working out for the German New Wave market.
Yeah.
A funny thing happened at last night's tryst. She was wearing a flashlight strapped to her wrist. Hobbinsy herpes. Hobbinsy herpes. Well, a hep strep, syph, scabies, mono, gono, herp. A
hop and see her.
Hop and see her.
Hop and see her.
Jimmy, great.
Hey, Ed, what about Weaver? Where's Weaver?
Weaver. Well, our drummer, Ken Weaver, was our drummer for a number of years, decided not to take part in these folks' reunions because he's swung to the far right. And he was applying for employment with the Central Intelligence Agency. And when he turned me down, one of the things he said was, I don't want to sing any songs against America.
Wait a minute.
Great tune.
Hey, wait.
I don't want to sing any songs. Hey, great.
Listen to this.
You have a charm. Who designed that garland?
I don't want to sing any songs against America, because it's been so good to me. But you know, sometimes it dips its hands in blood.
I don't know. I was saying, maybe we'll send it to Merle. I don't know. I mean, it's not our job to write the national anthem. I mean, give me a break. Hey, Tule, let's try that up-tempo song. Tule. Let's go. Sing for us, man. Let's do that. Bring us out of it, man.
Why don't we do it in the bed? No one will be out there. Why don't we do it in bed? Why don't we do it missionary style? Why don't we do it missionary style? Why don't we do it? Why don't we use a prophylactic? Why don't we use a prophylactic? So what if no one will be watching us? Why don't we do it in the bed?
Well, I don't know.
Never forget that Shalom Aleichem lost all his inherited money in the stock market. When the stapler runs out of staples, do not view it as an evil act of retribution from the cosmos. Do not mention your troubled childhood in the deal memo. It's the economy, stupid. on me. Those who do not know history are not compelled to repeat it. George Santayana was wrong. Yes, he was. Yes, he was. Do not use the word babe in a song, in a song. Do not, use the word babe in a song, or else, or else, or else. Hold on to what you got. On the other hand, maybe you shouldn't. It sometimes depends on the quality of the time flow, you know what I mean? Do not expect to be downloaded into an android body form anytime soon. The gutter sometimes wears a tuxedo. Why are you paying so much attention to your mental condition? Things got very strange up there in Mark Twain's mind, and he did okay. Do not allow. Anyone from the New Yorker, anyone from the New Yorker, into your kitchen, into your kitchen, or living room, or bathroom, pursue the small utopias, nature, music, friendship, intimate love. Pursue the small utopias, nature, music, friendship, intimate love. Pursue the small utopias, nature, music, friendship, intimate love. Pursue the small utopias, keep growing, don't snap. Try to be joyful. It's okay. Tap into the sugar tree.
When I was 7 or 8 years old, I began to read the science fiction magazines that were brought by guests into my grandparents' boarding house in Waukegan, Illinois. Those were the years when Hugo Gernsback was publishing amazing stories with vivid, appallingly imaginative color paintings that fed my hungry imagination. Soon after, the creative beast in me grew when Buck Rogers appeared in 1928. I think I went a little trifle mad that autumn. It's the only way to describe the intensity with which I devoured the stories. You rarely have such fevers in later in life that fill your entire day with emotion. When I look back now, I realize what a trial I must have been to my friends and relatives. I was one frenzy after another, relation after one enthusiasm after one hysteria after another. I was always yelling and running somewhere because I was afraid life was going to be over that very afternoon. My next madness happened in 1931 when Harold Foster's first series of Sunday Color panels based on Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan appeared, and I simultaneously discovered next door at my Uncle Bion's house the John Carter's of Mars books. I knew that the Martian Chronicles would never have happened if Burroughs hadn't been an impact on my life at that time. I memorized all of John Carter and Tarzan and sat on my grandparents' front lawn, repeating the stories to anyone who would sit and listen. I would go out to that lawn on summer nights and reach up to the red light of Mars and say, "Take me home." I yearned to fly away and to land there in the strange dusts that blew over Dead Sea bottoms towards the ancient cities. While I remained earthbound, I would time travel, listening to the grown-ups on warm nights, gathered outside on the lawns and porches to talk and reminisce. At the end of the 4th of July, after the uncles had had their cigars and philosophical discussions, and the aunts, nephews, and cousins had their ice cream cones and or lemonades, and we'd exhausted all the fireworks, it was the special time, the sad time, the time of beauty. It was the time of the fire balloons. Even at that age, I was beginning to perceive the ending of things, like this lovely paper light. I had already lost my grandfather, who went away for good when I was 5. I remember him so well, the two of us on the lawn in front of the porch, with 20 relatives for an audience, and the paper balloon held between us for a final moment, filled with warm exultations, ready to go. I'd helped my grandpa carry the box in which lay, like a gossamer spirit, the paper tissue ghost of a fire balloon, waiting to be breathed into, filled, and set adrift toward the midnight sky. My grandfather was the high priest, and I his altar boy. I helped take the red and white and blue tissue out of the box and watched as grandpa lit a little cup of dry straw that hung beneath it. Once the fire got going, the balloon whispered itself fat, with the hot air rising inside. But I could not let it go. It was so beautiful with the light and shadows dancing inside. Only when Grandpa gave me a look and a gentle nod of his head did I at last let the balloon drift free up past the porch, illuminating the faces of my family. It floated over the apple trees, over the beginning to sleep town, and across the night among the stars. We stood watching it for at least 10 minutes until we could no longer see it. By then, tears were streaming down my face, and Grandpa, not looking at me, would at last clear his throat and shuffle his feet. The relatives would begin to go into the house or around the lawn to their houses, leaving me to brush the tears away with fingers sulfured by the firecrackers. Late that night, I dreamed the fire balloon came back and drifted by my window. 25 years later, I wrote The Fire Balloons, a story in which a number of priests fly off to Mars looking for creatures of goodwill. It is my tribute to those summers when my grandfather was alive. One of the priests was like my grandpa, whom I put to Mars to see the lovely balloons. But this time they were Martians, all fired and bright, adrift above a Dead Sea.
This morning, I was sitting at a table at Book Expo America, a big trade conference for the publishing industry, when we started seeing news that Ray Bradbury had passed. And at the time, we were having some trouble getting confirmation of it, the wireless not being the most useful there. And we started seeing authors, artists, people in the industry and out posting their remembrances, their shock and disbelief and their memories of him. And as the day went on, we started seeing more and more. And as of this evening, we have two beautiful remembrances from two presidents of vastly different groups and organizations who have been brought together by a common interest. Our first quote is from President Obama, posted on the White House official blog today. For many Americans, the news of Ray Bradbury's death immediately brought to mind images from his work imprinted in our minds, often from a young age. His gift for storytelling reshaped our culture and expanded our world. But Ray also understood that our imaginations could be used as a tool for better understanding, a vehicle for change, and an expression of our most cherished values. There is no doubt that Ray will continue to inspire many more generations with his writing, and with our thoughts, and our thoughts and prayers are with his family and friends. That was posted by the President of the United States this morning. I'm talking about his personal reaction to this wonderful author who has been a pillar of our community. I also had a chance to talk to John Scalzi today, president of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, and which is a group that is dedicated to advocacy and support of the science fiction and fantasy writers around the world. Scalzi said, simply put, it is the end of an era. Ray was more than just an author, more than just a grand master. He was one of the pillars of our community. It is no coincidence that one of our major awards is named after him, the Ray Bradbury Award for Outstanding Dramatic Presentation. It is impossible to count the number of authors who have been influenced by his work. He was a writer of fantastic ideas, but he was more than just the ideas. He was about the words. He was one of the writers of our genre who could show the power of the words themselves. He used words in a way that continues to inspire joy in his readers and envy and admiration in his peers. We mourn his passing, but much more than that, we celebrate the arc of his life, his contribution to our literature and community, and the worlds that he left us.
This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is not what we were planning, but it is what has occurred. And we are Felix Gilman, who is one of the most gifted writers I'm aware of out there, whose third novel will be coming out in November, and we're going to have him back then. But this morning we are going to chat. And also with me, with us, is James Gates, J-A-Y-M Gates, because I know that you're not looking at the little subtitle on your radio. And she is a professional publicist and is the public relations director of the Science Fiction Writers of America. And, okay, I've got a story. I always have a story. Jane has hardly known me, and she's, like, sick of this stuff now.
I'm shocked that you have a story.
Shocked
I don't
and
believe this, really.
Okay, so when I was, whatever age I was, sixth grade, not a great student then or now, and I wrote a book report. And I finally found something I was enthusiastic about. The book was The Martian Chronicles. And the teacher just, like, didn't read the book report. I just got an F then and there. Because I am still of the day that, the old person that I am, that science fiction isn't literature. And, you know, it did no good to do the argument, well, what about 1984, Brave New World? You know, that's not science fiction, that's literature kind of thing. And this really, you know, annoyed me. He said, almost going near one of the seven words. And the number, where's the list? Number two.
Within my
we're
line
number
of sight.
Two. Because they wouldn't let me say pissed off. So eventually I became a dropout. You know, I mean, after junior high, I almost never went back to school. And by the 10th, and I started working here at WBAI since I was 13. So, you know, hey, you're in a hippie, weird environment. What do you need school for? So I just hung out at BAI, and I, one of these days, maybe on my 60th birthday in 2 years, I'll try to get a GED or something like that. I figure maybe it'll be time.
I would say this explains a lot about you, but it's, you know, I think it turned out fairly well.
I'm not totally displeased. I do not advocate the dropping out or anything like that. But sitting in the seat where I am now, in the engineering seat rather than the host seat, I have met the most incredible, wonderful people in the world. And was it about 11 years ago, Ray Bradbury came to New York. He did not travel a lot. He didn't care for planes, trains and other things. But he came by train in order to receive the National Book Award for the 40th anniversary of Fahrenheit 451. And through various means and through our arts director, Matthew Finch, I did a half-hour interview with Bradbury, which, by the way, we will broadcast on this show next week. But I got the wet dream revenge of all time, which is to say that I told Bradbury this story, and he said, well, let's just, you know, what was the name of the teacher? And I told him the name of the teacher. I have no idea if the guy was still alive, but I found the name in the phone book. And he just said, Dear Mr. Blah Blah, my name is Ray Bradbury. I was author of The Martian Chronicles, which you have flunked this fine young student for, and I am in town today to receive the National Book Award. I hope you're satisfied. And I have that recording, and now I'm going to play that next week as well, except I'm going to have to edit out the name of the teacher.
Well, and having a quote from the president on Ray Bradbury's passing.
That's an amazing thing.
I mean, it is beautifully illustrative, though, of where science fiction has gone in the last 60 years.
Sorry.
And John McCain. John McCain issued a brief statement as well.
Did he really? So there's actually... Yeah, pull the mic closer. No, don't lean forward. Relax, but just pull the mic close to you. We're so formal here at WBAI. This room, by the way, everybody, is like 110 degrees. I swear, it is airless.
So if we just start passing out or having fever dreams, you know
what happens. Well, then it'll be WBAI and you'll, you know, business as usual.
But, you know, these quotes from people, CNN covered it, CBS covered it, their quotes...
It's major news.
Yeah, it has gone out all over the place, and we're used to... We're kind of watching one of the old crowds pass, the old guard pass in science fiction and fantasy, and we're used to that. What we're not used to is having people who leave such gigantic waves... You know, and that we aren't the only people affected by them immediately and obviously.
I would dare say there are two sets of trinities in science fiction. There's the Science Fiction Writers of America.
Yes.
Trinity, which would be Asimov, Heinlein, and Bradbury. And then there's the one that people think of more immediately, which is Asimov, Clark,
yeah,
and Bradbury. Any way you cut it, there's Bradbury. And I read Bradbury first when I was about 6 years old. My uncle read his stuff to me. And it's a great age to get into the stuff. And when I was about eight, my parents gave me the two books, R is for Rocket and S is for Space, because they assumed that these were like, with titles like, what's the word? Like... You know, D is for dog.
The dandelion wine. The
no. Well, no. There's a word for alphabet books.
Alphabet books, ABC books.
Yeah,
on the showroom floor since 9 a.m. today, you know, in a row after the travel from Hades. I am not very coherent.
San Francisco's Hades now.
Yeah.
The airlines are. Oh, well, there's that, yes. Yeah, Hades Airlines is really, like, you know, the food they serve is really hell. But the...
Now I want to do this.
They thought it was a book for young people. It wasn't, but what it did is it made me reach. And James said something to me earlier today, which was that Bradbury really let young people know that science fiction, which was still barely out of pulp, and not barely out, I mean, Bradbury was a 13-year-old when he was writing letters to H.P. Lovecraft's fanzine.
Yeah.
Which is where he got started.
Well, we have an old, deep tradition. It's just that so much of it has entered the mainstream now that it kind of blurs the edges. I mean, who doesn't know who Cthulhu is on at least some level now? It's getting mainstream. It's on T-shirts.
And it was in the Cthulhu mythos then.
Yeah.
But everyone, my impression at least is that everyone in the U.S. these days reads Fahrenheit 451 at school.
Yeah.
Is that true or not true?
Unless you're in a state where they've burned it, yes.
Right. It seems to be sort of more.
Which did happen in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
Amazingly.
We will not name names here.
You don't remember what state that was?
Oh, I'm fairly sure I do, but I don't want to go posting accusations without
checking out the facts first.
And I think I have friends who live there, and I don't want to hurt their feelings.
Oh, dear. Yeah, but subversion begins from within.
Yes.
But anyway. Yeah. Well, you know, everybody, go to your favorite search engine and find out if your state was one of the states that burned Fahrenheit 451, and if so, vote differently.
Or, you know, just buy a copy of Fahrenheit 451 and give it to your local library, your local school system. You know,
it holds just, up.
Yeah. It is a book that I do not believe will ever go out.
And by the way, the Francois Truffaut movie is not half bad. I was very pleased that they did not remake it a couple of years ago. A couple of years ago it was in production. And that faltered, and that production is out. Now perhaps over his dead body.
Yeah, that's what I'm afraid of.
There are a lot of bad Bradbury movies.
The Beast
from 20,000 Fathoms, and he wrote the screenplay. It's no excuse.
The thing about Bradbury, though, is a lot of his stuff was cerebral enough that I think it would be difficult to express in the visual form. It's, you know, the things like the Illustrated Man,
doing
though.
That with Philip K. Dick.
Poor Philip.
Yes. But no one can stop them from making Philip K. Dick movies.
Yeah, but there have been some good Phil Dick movies. First of all, there's one that nobody's ever heard of called Barjo, Barjo.
I haven't heard of that, and that's
Nobody's heard of it. It's a French film made for about 2 francs, and it's based on Confessions of a Crap Artist. And it's a rather good film. The moment you start watching it, you realize, oh my God, this is really the real thing.
This came out a couple of years ago, right?
About 15 years old.
Oh, then I'm thinking of something else.
Yeah. Now, then A Scanner Darkly, directed by Richard Linklater, is really true Philip K. PKD. You know, I was almost going to use one of the words again on the, but no, that isn't on the list. It was really true Dick. It was Dick-esque. It really captured.
Yeah. Hollywood does not have a particularly fine track record of genre movies anyways. It's just, you know, we get a few gems, and then we get a few, most of the time we sit there and go, well, it wasn't as bad as I expected it to be. It wasn't horrible. It might have been okay.
I've seen two excellent stage adaptations of Philip K. Dick. The Mabu Mines, which is a very good local theater troupe, did Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said, which would not be the first thing you would think of as theatrical adaptation, and it was wonderful.
Yeah.
They revived the production before. I don't think they're going to do it again because it was very cast dependent at that time. And a co-author of it, by the way, was Dick's fourth wife. Not Tessa, but Linda. Anyway, and then about 2 years ago was Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Yes.
Written, adapted, and directed by Edward Einhorn. And I thought that was a wonderful adaptation. We did a three-way show where Matt Kressel, a writer and a member of the Altered Fluid Writers Group, who thinks that Blade Runner is one of the greatest movies ever made, was there to represent the interest of that film. I dissent.
This is a conversation that could have its own three or four series.
Well, we did a whole thing on it. And Edward Einhorn, who'd written the theatrical adaptation, was there to represent his, and I was here to represent the book. It was a wonderful show, if I say so myself.
Yeah.
And to just illustrate. But well, Bradbury.
I mean, like it said in John Scalzi's quote, one of our major awards for screenplays is named after Bradbury. So
Bradbury wrote, was an Academy Award nominee.
Yes.
For the screenplay of Moby Dick for John Huston. People forget that.
People forget a lot of things that are going to be remembered at times like this and brought up and discussed again. And I think it'll be very interesting to see how it stirs the water and, you know, what it spurs a little bit. We've just finished up the Nebula Awards, which are the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, the awards that we vote on internally. And
it's the peer award.
Yes, the peer reviewed. You know, like I said, not particularly coherent today. So we just got to see the new crop of writers. We have some fantastic young authors coming in, winning awards. You know, we have Connie Willis in there. We have the Ray Bradbury Award. So it's the timing of this is very interesting because we've just crowned the latest, greatest crop. And I'm seeing so many of them tweeting and posting to Facebook about, you know, I never would have started writing if I hadn't read Bradbury, or my writing would have gone a completely different direction. And, I mean, we...
This radio show wouldn't be here.
Yeah, it's the amount of foundation of the genre that is on his shoulders is just incredible.
So, whatever agenda may have been here for this week and next, and I have little doubt that if people tune in the Golden Age of Radio, Max Schmid's program, that they will be hearing probably radio productions of the Martian Chronicles. Max has an amazing collection of Bradbury stuff. I have a small collection myself of more of interviews and modern material. Sydney Smith, who is here tonight, I doubt he'll leave the topic alone.
This will be talked about for a while.
It will be. Will be, happily, because,
yes,
you know, it's a passing, it's a death, but he had a wonderful life. He did what he wanted. He lived till 91, which is a respectable...
There's less, we lost too soon, you know, as much as anything, it's all just that he has always been there for so many of us, and we'll miss him very, very much, just as a person and as a writer, I think.
He lived till 91, and he was writing things in the New Yorker the month of his death.
Yeah, exactly. And how poignant was that?
Yeah.
That's one of the nicest things.
It's a lovely, poignant thing in the New Yorker, but...
Oh, and I'm sorry, by the way, for not crediting that piece that I read at the beginning. The New Yorker, actually has its first ever science fiction issue, which is like, I don't know, saying like Fox News has gone liberal. It's, I mean, it's just not what anybody expects. I mean, the New Yorker has always published science fiction.
Yeah.
It just wouldn't acknowledge it.
Well, and the title of the piece is Take Me Home, and I think that... It is more poignant because of, you know, when it ran and his death and everything. It's when I was looking it up and reading it originally, I was very glad that I was not on air or not talking to anyone because I would not have made it through with my voice intact. It was just...
Well, I had trouble because I hadn't read it aloud. That was mostly a cold reading.
Yeah. I would have just lost it halfway through and had to walk off for a few minutes, so... You did better than I did.
Yeah, well,
I know, you've been doing this for a long time. Your advanced age and my relative, I am nothing but an infant in your eyes.
Oh, for...
Christ's sake! Anyway.
You started it.
I did. But not on the air, I didn't. Not on the air.
This is revenge.
Because I was talking about being here when I was age 13 mm-hmm. and reveling. And actually, my problem with my age is not that, not just what my age is, because I still act and behave like I'm 13. But it's that we don't have younger people here. Although I'm starting to see, I must say, there are a few younger people here at WBAI recently. I mean, young women in their 20s and stuff like that. And it's like, yes, thank you. If I was here when I was 13, where are the teenagers? Where are the teenagers?
It's never been that the teenagers...
Radio's cool.
Well, it's never been that the... Because publishing has the same thing. You go to panels and you hear, where are the kids? How can we get the kids? Oh my God, everyone's dying off. There's no one young anymore. And again, you know, Ray Bradbury engaged with kids. In his 80s and
90s. He started at age 13.
Kids flocked to see him. You know, he knew that the kids are there. It's just that we have to step back and stop going, how do we get the kids? And notice that the kids are there and start engaging them and talking to them.
Well, I'm not as concerned about kids as listeners. I'm concerned about kids as producers.
Producers, authors.
Podcasters.
But I'm talking in everything. I mean, the last few years we have had probably half a dozen authors release beautiful books. These authors are under 20 years old. I mean,
yeah.
I'm 24, and I looked at some of these kids a couple of years ago and went, what have I been doing with my life?
There was a wonderful Nebula Award nominee, which was assigned to me by Jame as an interview, who I would not have known otherwise, by the name of Eugenia, although she doesn't use that so much. It's E. Lily Wu. And I was mentioning to somebody else, you know, how young she looked. I tweeted some of these pictures, and as we broadcast the interviews that Jame and her staff and I did over the next matter of months, we're all pooling interviews and stuff. We'll also be posting pictures of these people. And this young woman, I believe, is graduating school this week. I have to get her on the air real fast.
Yes.
Because she's hoping to get a job on the West Coast. Her
yes,
first
we get her
job.
On our
her
side.
First job. Yeah, later this month. And but I mean, she's not out of school yet, and she's a deserved Nebula Award nominee.
Well, I
won't be her last time.
No, it definitely won't.
She's amazing, by the way.
She is. I don't remember who it was either, but there was someone at the Nebula Awards who specifically wanted to talk to her because they work in a high school teaching writing to girls, and she said that there's this entire crop of young Asian girls who worship Eugenia. Mm-hmm. Who has published almost nothing yet, is already a nominee.
Asian descent, I assume that she's born here.
Yeah, Asian. I'm not sure, but it's, I believe, a Chinese school that this
oh, okay.
my friend works
yeah,
at.
Yeah, but I think she's first generation American.
Okay.
Yeah. Of Asian descent, as I'm first generation American of German descent.
But, you know, it's even, I don't even think that her nationality is so much the question as the fact that she is just barely out of school, and she has
yeah.
a fan following of girls in high school who want to be just like her. These are girls who are not idolizing someone, you know, who is.
And they should
years
sing Scottish
senior.
Ballads half as well as she does.
I did not know this.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Tangent.
Sorry. Tangent. Franny Billingsley. You assigned
yes.
me Franny Billingsley, and I am so embarrassed to say I didn't know who she was. This is wrong, because Franny
Jim,
Billingsley is one
I'm
of the coolest...
I'm blocking you out of the Nebula Awards.
Really,
you will never be allowed to do this again.
Really, really. Then that's deserved, because...
I am joking, folks.
Her... Well, I've read three of her books since. She is so wonderful. She is so wonderful, and... But I knew the moment we started doing the interview how good she was. But it was a cold interview for me, which I don't like doing. I like being ready, not rehearsed, but ready, knowing who I'm interviewing, what I'm doing. But it was slight madness having lost the room. Actually, well, we actually lost the hotel rooms. The hotel was
Maryland
overbooked.
Hotel laws are a little bit interesting. We discovered this the hard way.
Yeah, except for one wonderful person at the hotel who I've written a letter to the hotel about, and I want Sifwa to do the same.
Sifwa will do the same if Sifwa ever gets home and sits down for 5 minutes and gets more than 3 hours of sleep.
Said Ms. Sifwa. And I'll send you a copy of the letter that I sent the Hilton, because the
Hyatt,
hotel.
Whatever it is.
Because they sent me a form to fill out.
Yeah, the highlight of...
What they did was, because they were overbooked, they sent us to, like, a hotel that only houses the 1%.
Which was a 30-minute cab ride away, and when you walk into the hotel, I mean, this is the Gaylord Resort. And you walk in there, and it's like walking into Grand Central Station as far as size, and a Caesar's Palace as far as... just general aura.
Oh, no, no. Caesar's Palace is not as nice. I've been
That's
there.
That's true. Okay. So you walk in
and it was
and
larger
go,
than Caesar's, which is pretty
I
huge.
I shouldn't be here. Can I just go away and go sleep on the street?
You know,
now,
they're going to throw me out. They're going to throw me out.
You feel like a bedraggled waif wandering up to the counter.
Not that the hotel in Washington where we were staying was bad. And thanks to this customer service person who knew that they were putting people out, they upgraded me to a suite.
Moral of the story, always be really nice and helpful to the people, to the staff at your hotel, because it's not probably their fault. And they often will do what they can to make life much better, and sometimes they flat out rock.
Yeah, and so James and I each had these really cool rooms for recording in, and so I had just finished with Franny Billingsley.
Also known as our bedrooms.
No, it was a suite. It was the office. It was the
yours was
room.
Mine you wasn't. I had a regular room.
You should have just been using space I had. Damn it.
We were double booked a lot of the time. We couldn't do that.
Yeah, yeah. But some of the time we weren't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyhow, next year in Jerusalem. No.
San Jose.
Next year in San Jose. Anyway, so here was the point of the story is James and I had thought we want to have one question to ask everybody. We'll have to do this to Felix before the night is out. And the worst question you can ever ask a science fiction writer is, where do you sci-fi writers get your crazy ideas? And
old episodes of Doctor Who.
Is he a real answer?
Without exception, old episodes of Doctor Who that people
Tom Baker era.
If it's recent episodes, people will recognize where you've stolen it from.
There's method.
Neil Gaiman. But anyway. Neil Gaiman was stealing from the old episodes. The Doctor's Wife was clearly old episode stuff. He was really going retro there.
He's a pro.
I do want to note on air by this point that I owe Felix about 3 drinks of his choice, having steamrolled him into this.
And given the temperature in this room, it is literally steamrolled.
Yes. So I just want that to be recorded on air, that I do owe apologies and drinks.
Apparently, I have nothing better to do at 1:30.
And a radio show.
Wander on to random radio
shows. I am really not going near that one. But anyway, the history is made at night. But is that a Preston Sturges movie?
No comment.
Isn't it?
Is it a Sturges or a Penthouse movie?
No, it's not a... Sturges never directed for Penthouse. Anyway, no. If it's not Renee Clair...
I am so behind on my movies.
It's Barbara Stanwyck, okay, James? It's Barbara Stanwyck. Anyway, now I'm going to get phone calls correcting me. But anyway, it's what always happens. If I make a mistake about science fiction, it's Molesberg who calls up. And I swear this is true. He does, and he corrects me all the bleeping time. But anyway.
Hey, someone has to keep us accountable.
That's Barry's
job. The scotch doesn't keep us quite accountable enough. We have to have someone to do it for us.
Indeed. So anyway, so I am running over with with Franny Billingsley, and I have to ask her this ridiculous question. And she gave a real answer, as Felix did, sort of. His was a little tongue-in-cheek there. But she said, I get my stories from Scottish ballads. Now, oh, this was, by the way, right after Lily said the one thing you're generally not supposed to say to a writer, which is, Franny Billingsley, I was reading you when I was six. That's the one you know, given that Lily is probably eight now. No, she's college. She's just out of college. But anyway, so that was acceptable because Franny's been writing for quite a few years. And but the moment that Franny said Scottish ballads, Lily broke into this version of Tamlin,
one of
my favorite ballads. And now I have 100, I'm not joking, literally 100. I had to give a copy of them to Kushner. That's Ellen Kushner, not Tony Kushner. Of this ballad of Tamlin, which was, by the way, also an off-Broadway production by Edward Einhorn. But anyway, we'd never heard this tune before. And it's like, which record is from that from? And she said, oh, was it recorded? No, I just know the sheet music. You know, we're all like, yeah. And she had a sweet voice. And then Franny said, oh, I know it like this. And she started singing. I turned the recorder back on and got duets.
Nice.
Of the two of them singing. And apparently, I then finished recording the interview with Lily. And then she caught up with Franny. And they went off and they found Ellen Kushner in the hotel. And they were doing Scottish ballad trios. That's a lovely story.
Yes,
I just,
and that is what really happens at science fiction conventions, folks.
It is true.
Scottish ballads.
it went at the best of them.
Yes.
And the Nebula Awards isn't actually a science fiction convention. It's a business meeting.
With workshops and
But that's the difference, is that, you know, at a science fiction convention, the typical programming is, you know, who's going to be the next doctor.
Yeah.
And
that's just bar discussion at the Nebulas, or you know, when you happen to be sitting at the table with Neil Gaiman and
anybody.
The poor boy can't get away.
Yeah. Or almost. I mean, Doctor Who is a weakness of us all, I think.
I am not really sure if it is safe to admit that I have not seen the last two seasons.
Yet. The first, then this is a whole conversation. I got Connie Willis after Capclave to finally start watching the modern Doctor Who. And that was cool and that was nice. But I submit that the previous season to the one that ended not long ago, which was the first Matt Smith season, the 13 episodes from beginning to end, is the perfect romantic comedy.
Yes, and looking at me, do you really think that romantic comedy is my genre?
Yes.
We're going to have a discussion about that once we're off air.
I'm almost willing to do it on air.
The romantic comedy is preferable to the endless, rather creepy, romantic mooning about.
This is true.
Of the previous.
It is. Simpsons, I mean,
which was. I like Doctor Who, but I could have done with less of that.
Okay, I actually like that. I like Stephen Moffat's writing, and I thought that his arc was good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of the first of the two seasons. Not of the latter. I am a dissenter on that.
Oh, no. I liked the Matt Smith one.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yes. No, I liked Matt Smith despite the fact that I was primed to hate him because he's the first Doctor who's younger than me. which is a terrible moment.
Yeah, exactly. No, they keep going younger and younger, and let's not get onto this for hours. But
in particular, in any English person's life, it's a terrible, terrible moment when Doctor Who is young for the first time.
When you come out from behind the couch.
And he was really young. He was really young, is the thing, because David Tennant, a little bit older than me, and I was expecting that this one would be about the same age as me, which I could just about cope with.
I got jumped.
I want to go through all the words on the list of words that I'm allowed to say, but I got jumped.
Okay, number one, number three, number two, twice.
Well, I'll have a side of number six.
Yeah, I want to go to number six. Oh,
Jesus.
Yeah. But I thought he was really good, and I was primed to intensely dislike him.
Yeah, no, I was as well. I had different visions. I had a vision of Adrian Lester.
I don't know who that is.
Ever watched the television series Hustle?
No.
The movie Primary Colors?
No.
And a number of Shakespeare specials. He's a brilliant black
in any
actor.
Form.
He's a brilliant, I would say, in his mid to late 30s black actor and all that. I've given up on this. For a while I thought maybe Bond, but it'll never go there. And one person came up with the perfect answer for what reboot character Adrian Lester should do. He should be the next Simon Templar. He should be the next saint. And if you don't know who Adrian Lester is, folks, look him up on IMDb. He's an actor with Shakespearean background and all that. I saw him first in the movie Primary Colors, in which he's the lead character, whereas John Travolta is the star. Travolta basically plays Bill Clinton. And on the campaign trail, all aspects, interesting movie, and based on nonfiction. And this is, but what I didn't realize, of course, was that he had pulled a Hugh Laurie. Adrian Lester is a great British actor, and I didn't know that he wasn't American.
This is one of my personal geek things, is there are just some fantastic authors coming out with, into the mainstream movies with stage and Shakespearean backgrounds. And we're starting to see some great new actors showing up. I mean, in Avengers, we had several stage.
Diana Rigg.
Yeah, we've got.
No, that's the other Avengers. Sorry. When you said the Avengers, you.
There's also a really, really bad Uma Thurman movie by the same title that was on Netflix Instant that I tried to watch, and
bad reboot of the TV series.
I was just sitting there beating my head against the wall 10 minutes in and decided I didn't need that much
It's
trauma.
Even worse than a bad Uma Thurman film. It's a bad Ralph Fiennes film and a bad Sean Connery movie. But it was miscast from the beginning. But for those who are not familiar with the original Avengers that starred Patrick McNee and then later brought in Honor Blackman and then Diana Rigg, this is one of the great TV series of all time. Marvel should never have used that name.
Wait, a reboot and Marvel
the movie
names
was,
and there are problems here?
Yeah.
So when did that start? This industry is just transparent and
last
perfect.
Time I had Chris Claremont on the show is the answer to that. But, oh, God, I'm supposed to call him today. But
you did. You just called him on the air.
Chris or Beth. Beth is. Beth.
It's going to be really bad if he does call in now.
Well, Beth will be at BEA tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
His wife.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's his kid.
Introduce her to me if you can, please.
Oh, I will. Absolutely. Thank you. She's wonderful. She's an agent. She's a literary agent with the Barry Goldblatt Agency.
Her, actually. Oops. Wait, with Barry?
Yes.
I am haunted by Barry.
Yeah, well, he was at an event tonight where I saw you. Yes.
No, Barry and I have a very interesting history that started with me making a thorough ass of myself and completely just.
I'm not going to say, but he, no, it's not disparaging of
No,
you
Barry
at
is
all.
Fantastic. It's I tend to put my foot in my mouth on a regular basis.
But he's like somebody else you work with, John Scalzi. He's a controversial character.
Yes.
Who will not hold back his opinions and will be very...
Entertainment is to give him a good drink. He has impeccable taste in alcohol. Give him a good drink and just start throwing movie titles at him and let him start giving you his opinion on
and
them.
Yes, exactly. I'll disagree with everything. It'll be wonderful.
Yes.
Well, I know of two employees, Joe Monti, who's a former curator of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, and Beth Fleischer, who is a former editor, I don't remember at what book company, but nowadays is a literary agent representing people like Odelia Sherman and Ellen Kushner.
Half of my social circle is represented by Barry, and I keep joking that he's trying to steal all of my friends from me, there, but he won't pay any of them
no,
back.
No, only 10% of them.
I know. And they just can't seem to agree on which 10%. It's like, you know, they don't want to take the hands off. I keep saying a foot would be just fine. They don't need to walk. I mean, they're writers. They just sit at computers, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to pay for this show.
Really, really. Well, we can edit this, except it's live radio. So anyway,
Hi, Barry.
Barry doesn't listen to a thing I say. I'm sure he doesn't tune in. Oh, I digressed myself out of conversation here. What was I?
That's a first. We were talking about...
No, it's not a first. It's common that I digress so much.
Mild levels of sarcasm there. Mild.
Thank you.
You were talking about the Avengers.
The Avengers. Yeah, the Avengers. At a certain age, boys of certain age, the Avengers, the best years were about 1966, 67, which is to say I was 13 and 14. You know, and that's just magical. It's a magical time, just as what doctor is the doctor when you're what's true. The proper age, true. Felix? Is it about 12?
Yeah,
the best doctor is the one who held the scarf or the mantle or the celery stick or whatever when you were 12 years old. That's who the best doctor is. It's very simple.
Celery stick.
Yes, Peter Davison wore a celery stick on his lapel.
See, I need to catch up.
That was the fifth doctor. Yeah. So, bearing in mind that we're currently on the 11th, counting The Curse of Fatal Death, in which there were like five doctors. But
It's not actually tremendously urgent that you catch up on this nonsense from the 1980s.
I like things nonsense from the 1980s, especially when nonsense from the 1980s it's British nonsense from the 1980s.
It is important for the first couple of years of Peter Davison because the story runner, the showrunner, was Douglas Adams, may I point out. So you can go about which doctor or that doctor or whatever, but the last two seasons of Tom Baker and the first two seasons of Peter Davison are overseen with a couple of episodes by Douglas Adams. And that alone, to me, justifies them as having a fun place in Skiffydom.
See, I'm one of those weird people that, so far of the new Doctors, the first one in the reboot, and I'm drawing a blank on his
Christopher
name.
Christopher Eccleston.
Yes, thank you. I was thinking Eccleston, and then for some reason it seemed like he was later. I have liked him better than any of the other Doctors. I've just liked them successively less and less. Recently, I've started to go, okay, maybe, but Eccleston just...
Eccleston was amazing.
He was so much the Doctor. Now it's these guys that really just... I don't know.
Did a whole other show,
yes,
again,
but
very briefly, when Russell Davies rebooted the series, and he'd already done The Second Coming with Eccleston, and... He did a three-part series with David Tennant as well. Casanova.
Yes.
Eccleston was the right person to bring back the Doctor.
Yes.
But he was a very mature Doctor. And Stephen Moffat, the current showrunner, in that year wrote The Doctor Dances in the Empty Child, mm-hmm. which introduces Captain Jack Harkness, which is the best character in that season. And
Jack Harkness is just one of the best characters in any season.
Period.
I mean, what?
Period. He's just fabulous.
Yes.
And so people are starting to realize, like, wait, the Doctor is very sharply intimating that he has history with Captain Jack. There is gay element going on here. And somebody, now this is, I'm not reporting, I am surmising.
Yes.
Somebody at the Beeb said, children's show, 8-year-old demographic, pull back. Eccleston reportedly did not care for where the series was going. My guess is because it was going to Kiddyland.
Yeah.
And when David Tennant came in, David Tennant is a brilliant, wonderful actor. Yep. It was Kiddy.
Yeah. That one season was, and most people don't seem to like Rose, but I really did like Rose as Eccleston's foil. And that season for me, I just absolutely loved it. And then she
became a clinger.
It just went downhill, and I've become successively less and less fascinated by
it. But the Matt Smith was a really bizarre reboot that I think works. I didn't love the most recent season, but I did love the first of the two Matt Smith seasons. I really did. As an arc. It had bad episodes, but as an arc, I thought it worked. Felix.
Yeah, I heard about Christopher Eccleston was just that he didn't want to be typecast as the Doctor.
There were some later articles on him where he was going, were issues.
That was the original cover story. But yes, exactly. I read what James read, that later on, and meaning within the last 8 months or so.
Yeah, it's fairly recent. Probably
very recent.
I'm guessing that some contract or NDA expired somewhere and he got to go be...
Or he finally just got tired of being chivalrous.
Yeah.
That he just didn't care. He said that he... quote, a paraphrase, didn't care for the direction the series was going to take, interpretation.
I'm not buying that the David Tennant episodes were more kiddie
than
the Christopher Eccleston episodes.
Eccleston was dark, and then you get Tennant in there, and there's
Tennant
a different...
was full of dark speeches as well.
Later.
There were endless dark speeches.
But he was more playful, more wild...
Not the first 3 or 4 episodes of Tennant coming in. Then it was hitting its stride and finding that sweet medium.
Yeah. But first few, it was just like, what happened to my character?
Yeah, the New Earth episode is Tennant's first, not counting the arm chopping episode. That was a kiddie show. That was a kiddie show, the Christmas episode.
Yeah.
And then the next one with the beautifully done cat people and all that. There are a few, you know, but then you get to Blink.
Yeah. Oh.
Then you get to Blink, which is amazing. A three-ing-mazing episode that... Some of the David Tennant episodes are superb. I'm not putting him down. What I'm saying is I believe that there was a little...
Well, my point is more that the Christopher Eccleston episodes were also essentially children's programming. Doctor Who is children's television. Doctor Who is for children.
I
love Doctor Who.
They were darker.
I love Doctor Who. Doctor Who's great, but it's a children's show, and that's okay. That's fine.
I agree with you, but by the time they were showing John Barrowman's butt, you know, and having male nudity while he's saying, "Here I am, boys and girls."
It was a gay-friendly children's show, which is fantastic and
wonderful
and great.
Clearly, I need to rewatch this because I don't remember that.
That's episode 12 of the.
Thank you.
Oh yeah, it's the game show one.
That's right. I disliked elements of that, so I don't usually...
Full rear nudity of John Barrowman there. It's I think there are gay bars that have that in full glory
probably.
On the wall.
Probably.
And that was the point. Not that it wasn't good, not that it wasn't even suitable for children, but prurient thinkers may think that this is not... what they want to expose their kids to. And after Doctor Who was largely killed by the Mary Whitehouse crowd, was it not? Mm-hmm. Mary Whitehouse, an unknown name in the US was this prudent woman.
All Doctor Who was killed by the fact that it was too expensive and
not well written anymore.
I
like Sylvester McCoy.
I can't objectively judge that because that was when I was, I suppose, I don't know.
I dropped out at Colin 12, Baker.
So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Sylvester McCoy was probably my doctor.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, he's a good one.
Yeah.
Colin Baker, who was...
I'll fight you over Sylvester McCoy.
Yeah. The only one who...
I'll referee this fight.
Yeah. But you know what? It's I do this all the three-ing time. We should be talking about other things as well, and not just this isn't just a Doctor Who show, because I'm so obsessed by it. This always happens, but it is interesting to note how many science fiction professionals are obsessed. And by the way, for those who don't know, the Ray Bradbury Award, which is where this came out from, which is the Nebula Award for Best Screenplay, and by the way, not Best Dramatic Presentation, it's Best Writing from the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers of America, was one given to a Doctor Who episode.
Yes, it was, and it was lovely of Neil to be able to come in and accept that and give a lovely acceptance speech.
No, he is. I loved his speech.
We also had an astronaut. So I
broadcast that 2 weeks ago.
I am very... I was not alive 2 weeks ago, but I was very excited.
You're not that young.
I died, and I'm like the doctor. I regenerated...
Okay.
About 3 days before I got on the plane again. No, we had an astronaut, so I don't really remember much else about the weekend because I was too busy making a fool of myself, you know, around the astronaut who's been out in space. And
he's been in space more than any living American. He has been
And then he told us that he loved us and that he didn't want to talk about space. He wanted to talk about science fiction books, and pretty much the entire crowd just kind of fell over and started squealing unintelligibly at that point.
No, and his speech
yes.
at the awards was fabulous.
I have never seen such a circular fan squee moment.
Yeah. You know, where he was basically saying, you know, you inspired us to go into space. Now, hopefully, we who are in space and have lived in space can inspire you and young people to be writing. It's like, oh, my God, I got chills up my spine. That was just so wonderful.
And then he says, and, you know, we believe what you guys write. And I was watching Twitter at that point, and the publishers and editors and agents were all just tweeting, oh, dear.
A Twitter.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
So I did a very, very brief interview with him, about 7 minutes long, having yanked him off the floor in order to get that done.
We have a lovely long one with Sifwa that will be going up in a while.
Who did that one?
I am Jake Carr.
Oh, he was very nice. Yes. I am so sorry I didn't get it. I have to make up to him.
The lovely thing about that interview, and I'm actually very pleased that it worked out, Carr was actually nominated for a short fiction Nebula, and his story was hard science fiction. And when it was originally bought or accepted by John Joseph Adams, edits were sent back.
For Lightspeed, I believe.
For Lightspeed magazine. John said, you know, here are all these changes that might need to be made for this to actually work as science. I don't really think this works. And talked to him about getting together with an actual scientist who specializes in this and making it correct. And Jake said, yes, I want to do that. And so John put him in touch with Mike Brotherton, who is one of the best experts on space and such things that there is out there right now, and who runs the Launchpad Workshop, which is about educating creative industry professionals about space and astronomy. And they worked together for months and completely rewrote the core science of the story to have a hard science story that is actually based in fact. And so it was really lovely for me after having, you know, after Carr went through all of that. And this was his first professionally published story that he got this nomination for. And it was lovely to have him sit down with that, all of that fresh in his mind, and interview someone who has actually been in the places that he's discussing in his story and who can relate to things like that. And Carr's a really good interview in the first place. And I'm mispronouncing, I'm sorry, his name is Kerr, but anyways, I'm sorry, Jake. The interplay between the two of them, the discussion that was going on was amazing, and it's a really great interview.
Well, my interview with Mike Fink was really just dead on. It was like, gosh, you're cool. I said that 5 or 6 times, and that was a great interview.
Mike sat there and went, I am so happy to be here.
Mike had on his professional NASA demeanor.
Yes.
As representative to who he was. And I really didn't need to ask anything. Knowing that this was for New York radio and non-commercial radio, he just did his rap about, his prepared rap about the synergy between science fiction and the realities of science fact that are yesterday's science fiction.
Yes.
And it was dead on perfect.
Well, and something
I cut myself out of the interview.
Yeah. At that point, you do want to just sit back and listen to him talk. One of the things that I kind of would like to start getting more attention from people is the fact that we, as science fiction writers, we are people that are shaping the future. You know, Star Trek gets so much grief. But if you look at the technology we have today, and then you look at Star Trek, and you go, oh, my cell phone kind of looks a lot like something that was on Star Trek, you know, communicators.
Regular listeners to WBAI are probably familiar with Dr. Michio Kaku, who has a weekly show in this radio station, who very much does. He wrote the book, The Science of Star Trek, you see.
Yes.
And he's a WBAI producer. And you wouldn't know that, but I liked it. Point that out. He did a lovely benefit for us, by the way, a month ago with his new book, The Physics of the Future. Whew, remembered it. That's where I did, that's where I practiced my crowd control for a signing.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh my God. That was quite an event that Kathy Davis, our public affairs director, put together.
Did Ray Bradbury ever write anything that actually was remotely hard science? I don't think he did, did he?
He wrote poetic hard science.
Yeah. I've got a great big pile of books on Mars on my desk at the moment because I'm in the middle of a draft of a new thing which is sort of vaguely a 19th century occultist go to Mars.
Oh, cool. Novel. Oh, I'm ready for that. Can I read it now? Sorry.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Be careful what you offer. We will take you up on that.
I will. Yeah. I will.
But I've got this great big pile of books and sort of weird 19th century stuff and various books about fictional treatments of Mars and fantastic treatments of Mars, and of course all you know, every book's got to have a chapter on Ray Bradbury and the Martian Chronicles.
It's
sort of halfway into the story you get to the Ray.
You have to mention, as Bradbury did, you have to mention John Carter.
You have to mention John Carter and the ship that sailed to Mars. And,
yes.
And what's his name? Edwin Arnold? No, Gulliver of Mars, the guy who goes in the carpet.
And of Lester course, Arnold. To bring us up to the present, Kim Stanley Robinson.
And of course, Kim Stanley Robinson.
Mars trilogy is one of my favorite hard science books.
2312, which I haven't read yet, but I hear...
Which I'm just finishing because I'm interviewing Stan on that book through Ellen Wright's auspices. Oh, God, help me, next week.
Oh.
So, okay.
Anyway, so I was...
No God can save you now.
The chapter on Ray Bradbury's Martian Chronicles always has quotations from Heinlein's letters about the Martian Chronicles, and he hated it. And he hated it because it was bad science. and it was weak, and it was fantasy. And it is, of course, fantasy.
It is
pure fantasy.
Although I would like to call it poetic science fiction, because they more or less... Bradbury was writing, you know, rocket jockey stuff. I mean, if you think about what's the story of the falling astronauts?
He was writing Cold War satire set on Mars.
Some of it. As far as the Mars stuff was concerned. The Mars stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well,
but you were saying Bradbury and hard science fiction. And I think the story with the falling astronauts who are falling into space.
I don't know that one.
Oh, my God. The Rocket Man. Would you like to hear a song based on it?
Not very much, no.
Well, it's a good song. And I've got it queued up.
Okay.
He said, then, in that case, don't listen.
Severe trepidation over here.
Okay, well, we're going to hold off on it.
I don't know if
the
listeners heard the song that preceded this show or not.
This is infinitely better.
Okay.
This is Tom Rapp. With the band Pearls Before Swine, and it is, I mean, you listen to it, you will know it's Bradbury. So, we're going to do it. And
whether anyone likes it or not.
And if it gets too traumatic for you, you know, the door is open, we can come and get you when it's all over.
Yes, exactly. So we'll be back shortly.
My father was a rocket man. He often went to Jupiter or Mercury, to Venus or to Mars. My mother and I would watch the sky and wonder if a falling star was a ship becoming ashes with a rocket man inside. My mother and I never went out unless the sky was cloudy or the sun was blotted out, or to escape the pain. We only went out when it rained. My father was a rocket man. He loved the world beyond the world, the sky beyond the sky. And on my mother's face, lonely as the world in space, I could read the silent cry that if my father fell into a star, we must not look upon that star again. My mother and I never went out unless the sky was cloudy or the sun was blotted out, to escape the pain. We only went out when it rained.
Well, we're not going to play the whole song because time is actually tight. But let me tell you that this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. This program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Felix Gilman and Jane Gates. Felix will be back in November. His third novel?
Fourth novel.
Jesus. Okay, your publicist owes me.
How can I get on the list so that your publicist owes me too? Because I want those other books.
Yeah.
Oh wait, it's a bookstore. Darn.
At any rate, we are here just chatting about various things. But that song is based. I think the name of the story is Kaleidoscope. WBAI actually did an adaptation of that story in which I was actually not an actor. I did the sound effect. I was one of the astronauts dying, and I was like, it was quite a primal moment. Steve Erickson was the producer of that radio drama here. And the idea, so this is that an astronaut falling from space into Earth's atmosphere, burning up in the atmosphere, looking like a meteor that they can't take a look outside for that. It's poetic and all that. But I would say there's nothing... It's not hard science fiction, but there's nothing that disqualifies it.
Right, right. Yeah.
Because Bradbury didn't really care.
No, yeah. He really didn't.
He was there to tell a story. But The Pedestrian, how isn't, you know, it's a weird tale, but it's science fiction.
I think it kind of boils down to definition. Hard science fiction is typically kind of in its own little box of, we have all this really cool tech ideas, experimentation, which we are going to show you now. Please sit there and read about all of these cool things. Whereas Bradbury, like you said, just told a story. The things were already there. He didn't really care to take the time to explain them because he figured his reader was smart enough to figure it out for themselves. He just told a fantastic story. And...
A literally fantastic story.
Yes, yes.
I mean, he didn't care if it was scientifically possible or not. He wasn't concerned whether there was or was not air on Mars.
Yeah, and that's...
That wasn't relevant to what
no,
he was doing.
No, yeah, and he had a story.
You know, Kim Stanley Robinson writes this amazing trilogy about Mars, and he did all of his research. He spent God knows how much time in Antarctica trying to understand... right now, I could... In this heat, I could use a little Antarctica. Trying to understand certain things about being in a certain kind of land. And he wrote this and that about the permafrost. And you know, the book was turned in, and it had something like a 15-month lead time to come out. By the time the book came out, what they had discovered about the permafrost on Mars had changed, thanks to Voyager. And his book was scientifically inaccurate. Well, take that, Heinlein. It doesn't bleeping matter. Yeah. Yes, if there were a newer edition, they would fix that.
And that's the danger that we run into as we're learning things so quickly about so many different scientific frontiers that you could write the most meticulously researched story and one little problem, you know, one little discovery, and your story is ruined. The Hadron Collider. I feel sorry for anyone who actually used that in their stories because a lot has changed.
Absolutely.
Since it was built. And
the world ended.
Yeah.
The LHC ended the world, was it like 2 years ago?
Yeah, we're actually just an echo.
Yeah.
Living on.
A blip.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is awesome because it means that technically I'm dead and sleeping.
There was a website called Will the LHC Destroy Earth and Everything on It? And you went to the website and it was one page that said no.
Nice. It's
one of my favorite websites.
That's better than the billboards saying, you know, the world will end on May 22nd on May 25th.
Yeah, no, those I took photos of those. We have about 10 minutes left, and I would like to open up to callers if you have something relevant to say. Notice the dip in the word relevant. And the telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. And so we're waiting for calls to come in. Felix, what are your novels?
So I've wrote two novels.
Oh, I'm sorry, folks. You're going to need to wear headphones at this point. Should be. There you go. You share those. No, the one with 3 ears is over there. I love radio. Okay. I'm sorry, you were saying yes. Thunderer.
So I was getting confused by how the headphones worked.
They're very difficult technology.
The answer is they don't. They're
tremendously difficult.
Here at WBAI, they are.
Yeah. It's strange. it's a strange sensation. Thundra and Gears of the City are two books that came out in 2008 and 2009, and they're sort of... big, weird city novels. Said one reviewer described them as meta fantasy, which I liked.
I like that.
I like that. I like that word. I read from one of them on this show a long time ago, and it was probably the first one.
It was.
Yeah.
It was.
That sounds about right.
And also at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings.
You read the New York Review of Science Fiction. Yeah. Yeah. And then I wrote a book called The Half-Made World, which is a sort of alternate world, vaguely steampunky Western sort of, or it's kind of a Western, it's sort of a the frontier sort of thing. And the new one is called The Rise of Ransom City, and it's a follow-on to The Half-Made World, and it follows a character who is traveling around the edge of the world, trying to drum up investors in his deranged machine, and then he sort of gets involved in the war to end all wars accidentally, and stuff happens.
Okay, I like World War One stuff. If you want to hit about 10 years, you might find an anthology of short stories, not from the teens, but from the 20s. James, do you know anything about a book like that?
No, I don't know anything. It's called Broken Time Blues, and it is an anthology of 1920s themed speculative fiction, which apparently Jim's lovely partner has a story in, mm-hmm. which we found out about half an hour before our first talk together, getting ready for the Nebula Awards.
We'd been emailing for a while, and I'm just saying, I know this woman's name. And Barbara's going, yeah, it's familiar to me, too. And then it was like, dung.
So, it was really fun to put together. The 1920s were such a transformative age. And so much turmoil.
And regular listeners to the show know I played two basic things, Scottish ballads and 1920s music. Yeah, that's what I play here.
So that was one of my favorite projects ever.
Well, Steel I Span counts, sales of silver, Lister.
And something I want to work on a lot more.
Yeah. Let's take some calls. Good morning, WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm one of your biggest fans
long-time
listeners.
To Jane? Oh, okay.
And I would like to mention two things. One, hello, Mr. Gilman. I have all three of your books in there. Awesome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And as related to Mr. Einhorn, I spent the earlier part of this evening at the 3LD Center.
Oh, you saw the premiere.
Opening night of The Lathe of Heaven, and it's awesome, too.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that.
It is just as good as Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
I'm so pleased to hear that, because we had a section of it out of context at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And in that particular space, it just wasn't the right space for that particular method of presentation. But Edward, it was a tech night. It was past dress rehearsal night.
Yeah.
So I'm so glad to hear that you enjoyed it.
Oh, it's a fantastic blend of the technical video projections and the acting and music. I think it's absolutely wonderful.
Okay.
And I adore the book. I saw 30 years ago the
PBS
film version
production
on Channel 13.
Yeah, there are two film versions. We despise the second.
And I think this is better than the film version.
Wow.
Yeah, the film version was awfully good.
I mean, I love that film version, and Le Guin's in it. She's in the dinner scene.
So,
well, thank you for letting us know.
Yeah. All your listeners should run out and go and see it.
Yeah, well, if it follows the way that Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep did, it's underattended in the beginning, and by the last week of the run, they were selling tickets on eBay.
Well, the first
that really
night
happened,
there were
$500.
Seats, but it was still a pretty good-sized house.
Yeah, that's about an 80-seat house, right?
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Sure.
Okay. Have a great morning.
You too.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Good morning, WBAI. You're on the radio. Yellow. We're on delay, so turn down.
Hi, Jim.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Two quick questions about Ray Bradbury and his influences. Was he influenced by Olaf Stapleton? And secondly, did he have any correspondence or ever speak to Philip K. Dick?
Olaf Stapleton, you would have to ask him, and I think we just missed the boat on that.
Yeah, right.
But I would, yes and no. I mean, you can sometimes see themes, but I don't think that Bradbury had the big, broad scope of Last and First Men or Sirius
right,
or those other works.
Yes,
he definitely had correspondence with Philip K. Dick. They lived near each other.
So they knew each other pretty well then?
Well, I don't know about pretty well or anything, but people who live in that part of California know each other.
Right.
For wonderful Philip K. Dick stories, one day I'll bring back Ron Goulart on the air, who was his neighbor, and oh, God, that's a whole other show.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. Have a good morning.
You too.
Good morning, WBAI, you're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning, Robert.
When I think of Ray Bradbury, I think of a story that has been so radio done, and I love it, called Zero Hour.
Mm-hmm.
Which
by three productions of it, yeah.
I know of at least two more, which were done elsewhere. One was done in Canada, one was done in Australia. And, you know, when you hear that story when you're 8 years old, it scares you. Especially the very last minute when Drill and little, what's her name, come into the room.
Spoilers? I'm sorry. I have to get a recording of Alex Kingston saying the word spoilers so I can play
oh,
that
yes.
at certain moments.
I apologize.
No, that's okay.
But anyway, Bradbury, of course, also wrote as far as I'm concerned. By the way, this radio fest shrift, now that's a lovely word, this radio fest shrift reminds me of an Irish wake without libations. I've been to a few Irish wakes.
Without libations?
No. I've never been to one without libations.
Okay, yeah.
Believe me, after about 6 hours, the libations are necessary.
Let me ask you something, Robert, about people who've been to Irish wakes. How bad is Jameson's? Never mind. No, don't go there.
No. Actually, I'll tell you sometime.
No, this is a private agenda.
I prefer Doors and Lefroy.
I love Lefroy.
I love Lefroy.
But that's not an Irish whiskey. That's a
yes.
Scotch.
Yeah,
no.
You could start
right.
international wars with that statement.
It was an Irish whiskey
awake.
Question. Yeah,
No.
Well, you really could.
I love
oh, my
Irish
God.
Whiskey
it's
too.
Happened.
Let me just say one other thing. When you mentioned the Scottish ballad trio, I would have been more surprised had there not been a Scottish ballad trio in your hotel, because I have found that Jim Freund mentions that one year he went to, how many was it, 40 SF science fiction conventions, you said, in 1 year?
Oh, that was 1979. Give me a break.
No. I'm going to make a comparison. I once went in a two-year span to 67 storytelling and folk festivals. And one of the things that you found, as I found, was if you walked around the halls, you found knots of musicians. And I remember in Winnipeg 1 year, finding at one end of the hall a group of us who then spent the entire afternoon doing North American variants of Thomas Reimer, Tam Lin, the wife of Usher's Well. Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, and another, by the way, speaking of Bradbury, another great story he wrote, great takeoff on Edgar Allan Poe called Usher 2.
Oh, yeah.
Usher 2.
There was a radio version of that.
There was?
Yeah, Max Schmidt has
oh,
it,
I'm
of
sure
course.
Sure, he does.
Yeah.
So that I'm not surprised that
it's a contemporary. It's not like X minus one.
No. I don't think so. But in any case, so I'm not surprised that there was that ballad trio doing comparative.
Well, you also have to recognize that you know there was this wonderful children's writer, this young woman from the Pine Barrens of Asian descent, and well, Kushner is a given, you know.
Yes. Well. Oh.
Yeah, but Southern Jersey. Yeah.
Who
exactly.
Who was the writer from the Pine Barrens?
E. Lily Wu.
Oh, E. Lily Wu. Is she steeped in piney folklore?
Yes. In all kinds of folklore.
Herbert Halpern.
I mean, her short story.
Yes.
Her short story. What was the name of the story? The Nebulon? Bees.
The Anarchist Bees. Something like that.
It's... We have to find a way to bring it to the air because of all this wonderful singing. I didn't get to do as long an interview as I wanted, and I don't care where she ends up, in Seattle or San Francisco or wherever it may be. I am going to get a tape recorder to her to read it. She has quite a voice. Quite a voice. We're out of time. Oh, I potted down your mic. Are you there? No, he hung up. Okay. I'm sorry. Now more calls are coming in, but we are indeed out of time. 90 minutes does speed by. So first of all, Felix Gilman, thank you so much for being here. I know it wasn't exactly what you were expecting.
It was fun. Thank you.
Good. Yeah. But we will have you back when your fourth novel comes out later this year. Mm-hmm. Maybe also in Years of Reading. I think you're due for one of those as well.
Sounds good.
Unless KGB has already booked you, in which case nobody should go. But everybody should go to the KGB readings. Oh, my God, there's one. There isn't one this week. I haven't missed announcing it. Okay. James, thank you.
You're welcome.
Was it okay for you?
My voice is probably not going to survive through the night, but,
yeah,
you know.
Not to mention tomorrow at... But anybody listening, attending a Book Expo of America... drop by the Science Fiction Writers of America booth tomorrow. There are several cool people signing, including Mike Cole, who was on this show not long ago. Will be there at 3:00.
Yes, I believe so.
I believe so. And Gay Terry will be there at 4:00. A person who works with Carol M. Schwiller. And I forgot who the first one of the day is.
Yeah, so did I. I've been looking at the schedule all day. But we also have information on Writer Beware and SIFWA membership and all those other
things. We have
to
do a whole radio show on Writer Beware alone.
Yes, get Victoria in here and
absolutely.
And
or
do
on
that.
The phone. I do her. Yes. I do that on the phone. Yeah. So again, thank you everybody for listening. I am glad that we are back out of fundraising time and actually doing radio here again next week on this show. My guest on recording will be Ray Bradbury. Thank you again. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister. Good morning.
an inferno. Cut my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies, the pigs, makeup. Imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Tommy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one, Panama. Talking about Peru. Azania. Brixton. Belfast. Can't forget Korea. Beirut. Can't forget Haiti. Iran. Puerto Rico. Colombia. Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua. East and South Central LA. California, IA. Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will. Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx. Yeah.
My man Joey to jail and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave. The free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
Wrapped up in that your love, baby. Never I know you missed me. I know you missed me. Yeah, I know you missed me. List Alive 99 Cinco WBAI. Wrapped up. Wrapped up like Cali Weed, y'all. This is Burn Baby Burn 99 Cinco. We do this every Thursday because it's your Friday, it's your Saturday, and it's your Sunday. Wrapped up. 99 Cinco. List Alive. Yeah.
Out on the street where the running looks so sweet. Me and the Kofi's get and drummy all look great. Life was the badness, we just cool and easy. Jah knows that we must be God bless, pick me after all. After all. After all.
Sick of the dice and bone, decide
she been